You're listening to Sweat, Snot and Tears, brought to you by Netmums. I'm Annie O'Leary.
And I'm Wendy Gollidge. And together we talk about all of this week's sweaty, snotty and tearful parenting moments.
With guests who are far more interesting than we are.
Good morning, Sweat, Snot and Tears crew. How are we this morning? We have had no sweat, no snot and no tears, which is a world record in our house. Wendy, what's happening in yours?
We've also had no sleep.
Oh,
bad times.
Who is the culprit this time?
The smallest. She woke up at 1 o'clock with a sore throat, which then turned into wanting Calpol, which then turned into wanting something else. And so I've not had any sleep, and I've had about 42 cups of coffee this morning. So good luck, Bryony. I apologise.
Well, I mean, I want, she sounds like me. Like, I wake up wanting Calpol, and then I want something stronger.
By about 9 a.m. Wendy's just let the cat out of the bag. Our guest this week is the fabulous, amazing, we love her, Bryony Gordon. Welcome, Bryony.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Oh, any time. We've wanted you for ages.
I didn't know that. You didn't ask me.
Have you had any sweat, snot or tears in your household this morning yet?
A bit of snot. My daughter's got a bit of a cold. That's like, wow. Everyone's like, God, that's fantastic. That's fascinating, Bryony. And I was supposed to go out and sweat because I like to do a little run, but I woke up. Oh, someone's at the door. Should I shut up?
No,
or can you take that out?
Whose phone is that?
It's Bryony's door. Is it Bryony's door?
It's not my door, no.
Oh,
God, that's my phone. Hold on, sorry. Oh, I'm just going to go and stop that.
What is going on?
Hello? Hi there.
Where's she gone?
Just a sore throat.
Uh-oh, it's a school.
Yes,
oh, no. That's happened before.
Yes,
as well.
This is the second time. We've had a school phoning with a potential COVID case before.
I'm absolutely gripped. Can we keep all of this in?
I really want to know what's happened now.
Uh-oh, the bubble being sent home. Is she being told off for sending her child to school with a sore throat?
I think that might be it, yeah.
It wouldn't have
or
been
it's the doctor.
But she didn't have a temperature, so surely you're allowed to send in with an ailment as long as it's not a temperature, right?
You can send them in with their arm hanging off.
Yeah. Maybe she's just going to go to school and not tell us. Anything can happen.
It is gripping. It is. Oh, do you think maybe it's the doctor calling her?
Right, I'm back. It was the school.
Go on.
It's the classic. So, my little girl has a sore throat, as we know, because she woke up in the night.
Yeah.
It was the school phoning me to tell me that there's a new policy that you're not allowed to give them Calpol before they go to school because it could mask a temperature. And so, if they have anything that requires Calpol, you shouldn't be sending them in.
So, what are you supposed to do? Go and get her?
I'm supposed to go and get her, but I've basically just said it's the nativity today. And the reason she's in is because she was weeping so hard at the thought of not being in the nativity, having practiced for 5 weeks. And it's just a sore throat and she's fine.
And did they believe you?
I don't know. The school secretary is something of a... I think they're all relatively terrifying creatures, school secretaries. So
I think they train them at the same place where they train medical secretaries, who are also basically vicious beasts. Sorry if there are any medical secretaries listening.
I just want to come in and say, why did you tell them that she had the sore throat and she'd taken the Calpol?
Like, because we sent some Calpol in so they could give her another shot just before the nativity to keep her going.
That was your error.
Foolish woman.
Just tell her to woman up, get on with it.
Get a big girl pants on and soldier through.
I'd like to say for the podcast record and to apologise to my husband who told me this would be the case and I poo-pooed him and here I am. He was right and I was wrong.
So will they leave you alone now?
I hope so. I apologise for the phone ringing.
That's all right. If it rings again though, God, this could run and run. Right, come on, let's get it back on track. Right, Bryony, I want to know, do you always exercise in the morning?
Yeah, I tried to, not always, but like every other morning. But this morning, I woke up and I'm like, I don't know about you, but I think it's because I'm now probably possibly entering perimenopausal stage.
Oh, I think we're all there, Brian.
No, we're not. I refuse to believe it. I'm never going to be. No.
I woke up and I was like at that stage of my period where if I move, it's like. Like, how do I put this delicately for people that might be listening to this?
Just say it.
Like, my period's so heavy that I basically have to just stay lying down on my beds. That's my excuse anyway for not being able to go out for a run. It's completely coincidental that it happens to be blowing a gale and it's windy and rainy. But, yeah.
I think this is quite interesting because I've been charting this over the last few months. In my cycle, there are times when I exercise loads and then times in my cycle where I just can't make myself. Do you think there is a link between hormones and being arsed, basically?
Yeah, I think there's a link. Hormones, I love this thing where, like, as teenage girls, we learn this thing of, like, oh, she's just hormonal. Like, there's no just about hormones. Hormones are the most powerful chemicals known to humankind. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, yes.
And they do affect us massively. And I've really got in tune with all of that.
So tell me what the morning routine is like in the Gordon household. Is it frantic, or are you one of those awfully organised people for whom mornings just float by in serene, I can't think of the word, just serenity?
I'm a morning person, and I didn't used to be, can I just caveat that with, so people don't go, oh God, we don't want to listen to this.
Wait, did you make yourself become a morning person, or did it just happen upon you?
It happened when I got sober. So I wasn't a morning person because I was an active alcoholic.
That can sometimes be a clue.
That has, like, I don't know if anyone out there listening, but like when you are permanently hungover, mornings are not your friend. But I got sober 3.5 years ago, and it's amazing. You get tired at the end of the day. Who knew, right? You get tired at the end of the day. And when you don't have alcohol, like the sort of
pep you up.
When you don't pep you up with that sugar, you naturally kind of wind down and want to go to bed. So I'm usually in bed by about 9 reading. Again, fascinating anecdotes I'm giving you here. but so it means I wake up really early, and I kind of have this thing. I tell you what it is, guys. As someone who has experienced mental illness and all of that stuff, I find that if I don't, I always remember hearing this once when I was in a really bad place, and it was the Archbishop of Canterbury on Desert Island Discs, right?
Here we go.
Justin Welby, and he was talking about, he had this terrible tragedy where his daughter was killed in a car crash, I think, and he was talking about how faith had got him through, and he had this saying that he, and I remember hearing him say it, and he said, attack the day, don't let it attack you.
Oh, I love that.
That really summed up for me. Obviously, even though I haven't experienced that awful tragedy, it was felt very helpful, actually, as a thing to say to anyone who's experienced mental illness or mental health issues. And I find that if I don't take control of my day as soon as my eyes open, it'll take control of me. And pretty quickly, I can be, you know, lying in my own sweat and self-loathing. So I've learned very much that I have to get up and get on. And even when I don't want to, and let me make this very clear, I mostly don't want to. Okay. It's not like I spring out of bed like a Disney princess with like birds flying around my shoulders. Morning. But I know that I will feel better for it, even if I don't feel like it. And so I kind of guess I've had to program myself into that. And I did read something recently about how, like, how you spend the first 10 minutes of your day totally, like,
sets the tone
for the rest of the day. So I've learned through a lot of fuck ups, can I say that?
Yeah,
I don't know.
Say what you want.
And failures, and not that I have to be a morning person.
It makes a change, Bryony, that someone's swearing other than me, to be honest. So go for your life. Make me sound better.
But also, I only have one child, and I think that makes a massive difference.
How old is she now, Bryony?
She's 7. And
is she a morning child?
Yeah, she is. I mean, aren't all children morning children?
No, because I've got one lark and one owl. The 6-year-old bounds out of bed at like 5 if she's allowed, whereas the 9-year-old cries at 8 and says, I can't get up, I can't, I'm not ready.
Well, that's interesting.
So yeah, mine are a mixture.
She's a definite lark. And my husband is not a morning person. Like, he may even still be in bed. Like, he's better. Especially
is
since
he there now?
He's in the house, like everyone's, you know, because he has to work from home. And I've noticed he's got, as this pandemic has dragged on, his wake up time has got like later and later and later and later. And I'm like, you are going to have a shock to your system when you have to go back into an office. I don't know if you had this, but like having to return to an office after maternity leave.
Yeah.
That's what I feel this year. It's been like a maternity leave, but you've had to work through it.
Yes, that's exactly and what it's been like. It's a very good analogy,
it.
Yes.
Maternity leave with homeschool, it's like...
I don't know, it's like all of the shit bits of maternity leave and none of the good bits.
Yeah, none of like, the coffee mornings and cake and gales.
None of the coffee mornings and also... like all of the worst bits, like losing your confidence because you're not having those interactions with people, you know?
God, you're so right.
I'm quite interested by this. How's lockdown been for you? Because obviously the kind of the mental health charity, would you call it a charity?
It's not officially a charity, okay. But it's a not-for-profit.
Okay. But that's all about connecting people when they're not feeling great to have a chat and move, basically.
Yes.
So
yeah.
How does lockdown affect you when that's what makes you feel good?
I have a real in fact I've written an entire book about this because I'm really fascinated. This it's called No Such Thing as Normal.
Oh yeah, I was going to ask you about that later.
Yeah, it's all the things I've learned about being mentally well from being mentally ill, basically. And the idea came to me at the beginning of lockdown because I was so fascinated. But like when I was a child, I had really, I had obsessive compulsive disorder to the point that I couldn't leave the house for long periods of time. And I was scared that I had got an illness that I was going to pass on to my family. And I had to sleep with my toothbrush under my pillow. And I washed my hands, you know, so obsessively until they bled. And what was really interesting to me was that when this happened, I wasn't in the least bit concerned. Obviously, I was concerned, but I didn't have that. My anxiety levels weren't there.
Which is
good. What I realized was that all of the people I knew who had experienced some sort of mental health crisis were actually taking it in their stride, you know, this notion that the world was shutting down like bit by bit in sort of slow motion. You could see it coming towards you, right?
Yeah.
And so the people that I knew who had experienced mental health crisis, like my friends who had been in, my friends from sobriety, or, you know, people that had experienced very terrible depressions or breaks from, you know, they were okay. And then the people that I always knew, the people I'd known who had always appeared to breeze through life, who hadn't experienced any of that, they were the ones who really struggled and became very anxious and panicky.
Yeah.
And the weirdest thing was that they started coming to us. Give me advice. And I thought this was so fascinating. And it was like this kind of curious inversion of norms, right? But also, I realized that all of the things that I had thought were flaws and failures and that made me a bit of a freak, I realized were actually more like superpowers, right? And that really came to the forefront of my mind when I was at the beginning of lockdown. And that's how I came up with the idea for the book, because I was like, actually, it's only through mental illness that I have learned so much about mental wellness, you know, and how to keep myself not sane, but, you know, somewhere close to it.
Yeah.
And so I really wanted to explore that. How can the things that we always perceive about ourselves as being negatives, how are they actually positives, you know?
Mm.
And so in that respect, going into lockdown, I felt kind of fine, you know, I wasn't panicked. I sort of had this, I think people that have had mental health issues, we very much have like prepper mentalities. Do you know what I mean? Like, I've always, but no, but like, I've been preparing for the end of the world, like my whole life. Like, the world was always about to end in my head, you know? And I'm not talking about like a zombie apocalypse or whatever, but just like, I always lived in this intense fear that I was the worst person in the world, that, you know, I was going to be.
Well, yeah, they say if you're having a crisis, you really want someone with really bad anxiety on your team, because they'll have thought through every scenario and made a plan for it already anyway. And so they'll just be ready to kick in with it.
But this is the thing. So like, I had thought, you know, my world was going to end because I was, you know, I had an abusive boyfriend, or my world was going to end because I was in a terrible depression and I couldn't imagine when it was going to clear. My world was going to end because I was in active alcoholism and addiction, you know, all of those reasons. So when the world as we knew it actually started to end, and we all had to like lock down for the greater good of humanity, I was like, this is a walk in the park, you know. Like a general lockdown is easy compared to the lockdowns that, of course, we, you know, people that I've experienced in my head by myself, right?
Yes.
But then.
Yes, because at least we're all connected through this, right? You're not suffering on your own.
Yeah. But I, and there's a big but here, because I think that the other thing that as this pandemic has gone on, and I think it is really just, it's clear it's really, really bad for mental health, right? So, you know, the loneliness and isolation. But the thing I've always said is that all mental illnesses, what they all have in common is that they thrive in isolation. So they isolate you, right? So they tell you you're a freak. They tell you that you're alone. They tell you that no one understands what you're going through. And they're like, it's like if you imagine like the culture of silence, like an abuser, right? That's how they get their claws in, right? But actually, the truth is that not only is there someone out there who understands what you're going through, there's someone out there right now who is going through what you're going through. Okay. And once you can blow a hole in that and you can go out and meet other people and connect, you're not cured, obviously, but you are on the road to recovery. And what I have learned as an alcoholic in recovery, as someone who's had obsessive compulsive disorder since they were sort of 10 or 11, you know, and is that what I realized was I came into lockdown and I had this kind of like bank of well-being, right? That was really, it was full, it was topped up. It was like I had a little savings account as well. I was like, yeah, because I've done so much work on myself. I've been to rehab, I've done therapy, I go to AA, I go, sorry, 12-step meetings 3 times a week. Do you know what I mean? I'm pretty like, but as lockdown has gone on, that bank has been very badly depleted, right? Because I can't go to 12-step meetings anymore. My therapy is all online, and you know, and I'm not interacting with people. And so now I'm like slightly in debt.
But yeah, I think we all are.
I've realized that, you know, it's so insidious, like depression and anxiety and all sorts of other, you know, it really creeps up on you, and it has a voice that is indistinguishable from your own. So you think it's you. And so the bits of lockdown that I really welcomed, like the bits where I was like, oh, actually, I'm really glad that my diary's emptied and I don't have to go into town on the tube and have inane meetings. And, you know, I don't have to stand up on a stage and do all those things that have always terrified me. I realized that actually isn't me. That's the unwell bit of me, like who I call
saying,
Jared.
Retreat, isolate. Yeah.
Who you call what?
I call him Jareth the Goblin King.
I love it. I love that it has a name.
I love that it's a man as well.
Well, it's like, I don't know if you've seen Labyrinth. So Jareth
of course, is
the David Bowie character, who as a child, I always felt he's evil, but ever so slightly enticing. And that sort of summed up my OCD. And so Jareth, like, and I first named him in my second book, Mad Girl, which is all about my OCD. Yeah. And Jareth, he's become a sort of recurring character because he's not just my OCD, but he's also now like my alcoholism. But Jareth at the beginning of lockdown was like, get in, boys, this is brilliant. Do you know what I mean? And he has this voice that's really similar to mine. Not that I sound like David Bowie when I sing or anything like that, but, and I think that that's me. I think, yeah, I'm happy with this. This is me. I don't want to see anyone. State-sanctioned isolation, get in. But actually, I realise over lockdown, sort of unpacked his bags, got comfortable in the forefront of my brain. And as a result, I've had a few, you know, I've had a few issues. I was very bulimic in my 20s. As opposed to a little bit, like you either are or you aren't. And though that didn't come back up, the binging certainly did. And I just started treatment actually for binge eating disorder. And because I could see that I was like losing myself in food. I was numbing myself in the food in the same way that lots of people were numbing themselves with alcohol. Do you know what I mean? Because it was like I hate to say this, it sounds so dramatic, but it was like a traumatic event, right?
Yeah, of course.
So, you know, like, I think it's not been fantastic for my mental health, but that's to be expected. And what I do know is that it's just another rung on the ladder that is my mental health and my journey. I hate that I've just said the word journey, but you know, it is what it is. and this is the great thing about having experienced mental illness and having been privileged enough to be able to do the work for it, is that I can deal with what life throws at me. Do you know what I mean? So life decides it's gonna, you know, I'm gonna have this experience like everyone else where we're all locked down, and then my bad coping mechanism for it, where devoid of my good coping mechanisms, I decide to numb myself, but I'll work it out and I'm getting some help for it. And so that's okay. You know, I'm in a really privileged position because I can afford to do that, you know, but, yeah. And I have the knowledge and that, you know, I've got the, through my work, not because I'm like, you know, brainier than anyone, just through what I do, to know where to go. But like, I'm aware that there are loads of people out there that don't have that privilege. Like, they can't afford to just they don't know where to go for help, and then they can't afford to have to go, they can't afford to pay for the help. The help isn't necessarily always available. Well, it is available on the NHS, but you have to go through a very long waiting list. So basically, I've made it my life's work now to use the platform I have to kind of like campaign for people that don't, you know, everything I've learned to try and change things. So really, I think the thing that I've worked out in lockdown, which is kind of at the center of this book, is trying to kind of help people how to access what is there and how best to get in it, and
or even how to make the things happen for free. Like, you know, Mental Health Mates, you don't have to pay for it, do you?
No, it's free. So I really saw during lockdown that need people had for help and for connection. And I saw as well, you know, I could see the kind of the effects that, you know, on an anecdotal level, that this was not going to have a great effect on people's mental health. And So I guess with this book, I sat down and I spent like quite a lot of my lockdown, I spent on the phone or on Zoom to people working in the NHS in the mental health sector, but also paramedics, social workers, interviewing them to find out the advice they would give to people, like the best way to get help in the system and what there is. Because I realised, you know, the focus on the NHS and what was there, it made me realise that it's in our it's in our DNA, written into our DNA, what to do when we are physically unwell or when our child has a fever, you know, for a few days. We know what to do, but it's not written into our DNA what to do if we find ourselves in mental health crisis or someone we love is. And so I suppose I've spent lockdown trying to unpick that and put it into this book so that people can, so it's not just the things I've learned, but it's also what is there. Because we hear so much about mental health provision being really bad. That in itself isn't very helpful if you're in crisis.
No, absolutely.
Because you feel like you've lost the battle before you've even begun.
Yeah, exactly. So I was like, yeah, but there is stuff there, and how do we access it? And the more that we access it, the more that the people in the NHS can go up higher and say, look at all these people that need this. You need to give us more money.
Yes.
So yes. I'm sort of, making the case that every time someone asks for help, they're being like an activist in a way. They're being like a mental health advocate, because they help every single person out there, you know, who might need help in the next 10 years or whatever. I've really gone off topic there.
No, you haven't. Wouldn't it be amazing if this was taught in schools? Wouldn't it be amazing if you left school knowing how to advocate for yourself and for others when it comes to mental health and how to get help when you need it?
Also, wouldn't it be amazing if we just taught kids, like, this is the other thing I talk about, like, if we just taught kids how to feel their feelings. It's a very simple thing. I don't know about you, but when I grew up, if I cried, the instinctive reaction from my wonderful parents, who I love dearly, but it was, don't cry.
Yeah, absolutely.
Come on, you're okay. Don't be silly. Come on, it's all going to be fine. Yes, yes.
Yeah, and actually, you know, I have to remind myself and say to my daughter, when we're at home, I have to say to her, actually do cry, you know, cry, get it all out. Let's get this out. Let's talk about it, whatever. And we sort of teach kids how to live happily ever after, but life isn't like that.
No.
Sadly, they're all going to come up against some big struggle at some point in their lives. We've got to teach them how to deal with it, yeah.
Of course. And the best way to deal with it is to just deal with it and not to ignore it. And I think
yes.
that when you grow up thinking that happy is the only goal.
Is normal,
and
yeah.
And happy is like, and that all other emotions are sometimes bad. You know, obviously happy is great. Like happy is, you know, it's a wonderful thing to be, but the idea that you could be it all the time and that if you're not happy, you're sometimes a failure, is it's the thing that makes us actually. It leads to so much unhappiness. So
how do you teach your daughter this? We're big believers in the feelings wheel in our house. We have it pinned to the fridge and I make them get it down and say, like, how are you feeling right now? How do you do it with your daughter?
Well, I think I don't so much do things like that because I'm really bad at crafts and I can't draw things. And so she'd be like, what is that? Is that a feelings? What is it, Mom? What is it? But I don't undermine the way she's feeling. You know, obviously I'm not like, oh, my little darling is crying, everything must stop.
But it's sometimes really hard though, because if they're crying over the fact that their Weetabix has milk on, or their Cheerios are the wrong colour, or whatever it might be, sometimes it's hard as a parent not to be... You can't always validate their feelings is what I guess I'm saying.
No, but I think if you're in tune with your feelings, you're much more likely to be able to go, okay, babes, or whatever you call your child, like... You seem to be really frustrated here about your Cheerios, okay? I don't think it's about the Cheerios, is it? Yeah. Like, what's
Are
going
you tired?
On?
Is there something
Are
else
you
worrying
tired?
You?
Yeah. Is there something else worrying you? Do you want to have a chat about it? And maybe if you just eat the Cheerios, you'll feel a bit better, and we can have a proper chat about it. Like, obviously, no, it's bloody annoying when they decide that, you know, the world is ending because they can't find their Salvadian or whatever. But what I mean is it's about kind of holding them in that moment, because kids will have tantrums over things we think are stupid. But it's like being able to hold them in that moment and kind of work out and just let them have it. But also let them know that, you know, you're there if they want to talk about anything else, you know.
Mm.
Obviously, you don't want to, like, let a child believe that they can just go out and have a tantrum every time they don't get something they want. But it's, you know, I think if you're more sensitive to a child, you know, children, the world is a scary place. And remember when you were a child, like, everything you felt, you're feeling it for like the first time, and you don't have the context, and you need to be a bit guided through it. I used to be, believe it or not, the most painfully shy little girl, and the thought of going to like birthday parties or whatever absolutely filled me with horror. I would be anxious about it for like days before, and, you know, perhaps get upset about it, you know, and it may seem silly to a parent, but you have to remember that what it feels so real when you're little,
having validating feelings is massively important, isn't it? Because it's only then that you can move through it, isn't it?
But also I think you can steer them through tantrums, you know, and go, okay, should we breathe? Should we try breathing? And then if they don't, you know, if they still want to continue having a tantrum, then you can...
My son was having a meltdown yesterday and I said, right, let's breathe. Let's do 10 deep breaths. We got to like 3 and he's like, I'm fine now, Mum. Okay, let's just move on.
There you go. See?
It's like, great.
But we had to introduce a code word.
I love that you do this, Wendy. It's brilliant. Go on, tell her.
So my eldest daughter, she's 9 now, Bryony, so she's getting into that stage where there are feelings that probably are hormonal, that she just feels meh and she can't tell us why. And it means she'll be being mean to her sister and grumpy. And so basically now, if she's feeling like that, she comes and tells us that she feels flamingo. Word of her choosing. And all it means is that she knows she feels off kilter and she knows she's not quite right, but she doesn't yet know how to make that better. So please, could we not shout at her because she's not being grumpy because she's being grumpy. She feels flamingo. And then we usually throw food at the situation, first of all, to see if it's calorie deficiency and, you know, that kind of thing. But it's working really well, actually.
Yeah. That is a good idea. I feel like my experience as a child, like, we can't stop children from feeling bad things and we can't stop children from experiencing mental illness. Like, I our mental illnesses are our brain misfiring in the same way that all our other organs might misfire over our lifetimes, you know, and usually they're misfiring to try and protect us in a kind of in a misjudged way. So I now realize that my OCD as a child was my way of trying to keep myself safe, but it obviously didn't work, you know. But there are sort of all sorts of primal reasons that our brains can respond in slightly skew-if ways, which I kind of write about in the book. But I know that if when I was a child, I didn't, not only I felt like a freak because I felt these things, but if I then also didn't feel like a freak because I had no idea how to kind of talk about them to someone, do you know what I mean? Like I was completely alone in my head. And because there was no vocabulary for mental health in the early 90s, late 80s, and there was no kind of, you know, there wasn't really any provision at all. And, you know, my parents didn't know what to do. And so I just was the difficult child, you know. Yeah. And there are so many difficult children, you know, whose lives grow up to be blighted because there wasn't the help or the understanding out there.
Yeah, the understanding.
To deal with conditions which actually we know are incredibly treatable if you get them, you know. And so what happens is difficult children are, you know, are prisons are populated with people who would have been deemed difficult children. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Like addiction, alcoholism, it's all of that stuff. And it becomes this sort of self-fulfilling prophecy. And actually, it's something that is quite normal, actually. Obviously, it's complicated and it's not as easily quantifiable as a physical health issue. But it is treatable and it is doable, and there are ways we can get through it. But the only way we know how to do this is if we all talk about it more. Do you know what I mean? Mm. And we shout about it, and we let the government know that there needs to be more funding for it. I'll shut up now. I'm going off on that.
This is brilliant. So, is your daughter aware of your mental health struggles?
In so much as she knows that mummy can't drink alcohol because she's allergic to it. And she's like, what happens if you drink it, mummy? And I'm like, well, I go a bit mad and run through the streets naked. And she's like, but
love it.
She was like, don't
drink it, mummy.
But she was like, because I did run a marathon in my underwear.
I was going to ask you about that.
I was totally sober.
How to confuse your seven-year-old right there.
She was like, is that why, but you do that now, Mama, even though you don't drink. I'm like, okay, we'll forget that analogy. But yeah, so we talk about it and she knows that I have, you know, therapy and that I take medicine. But I don't have sit-down conversations with her.
No, but it's just part of daily life.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I hope she knows that she can come and talk to me, and if not me, someone else, because it doesn't have to be me, but in the same way that she would, you know, if she has a headache or whatever, or a sore throat, or, you know, that's my aim, really. I don't for a moment think that I can protect her from the complicated nature of life, but I do hope that when she comes up against it, as she inevitably will, she'll feel that she's got somewhere she can go and be held through those experiences. God, I sound like some right wanker, don't I?
No, you don't. So what I was going to, if someone said to me, tell me about Bryony in a nutshell, I would say that you're someone who's basically taken on the challenge of dispelling the myth of normality. And just embracing what life really is. Is that what you'd say you're about?
I think so. I think that we all go around trying to put ourselves in the box marked normal. And of course, there are some people who hate to be described as normal or whatever, you know, but they are by and large in the minority, right?
Yeah.
But I always say, like, how many layers am I going to have to get dressed in this morning so I can put myself in the box marked normal, you know? There are so many things that we think make us really weird, you know, that we think are freakish. But actually, when you speak them out loud, you realize are really common. So, you know, an example being the binge eating. And I put a post up on Instagram because
I was going to ask you about this, actually, because I think it's so common. I think it's...
Well, this is. It's the most common eating disorder there is out there. But because we think eating disorders are about restricting food, not binging.
Yeah.
And of course, they're actually two sides of exactly the same coin, those things.
But it's been normalised, you know, Sex and the City or friends or whatever, if you were feeling sad, you watched the people in those shows sit and eat a whole tub of ice cream to make themselves feel better. It's become something almost that's been normalised as a coping mechanism.
I feel like it's always been a coping mechanism. I think that food is the first thing as humans that we learn we can have power with. So our parents try and feed us broccoli, we chuck it on the floor, yeah? So it's very deep rooted within us, you know. And it's often when you speak to people, it's like you speak to alcoholics or addicts in recovery, they will tell you that actually their first addiction was food. You know, they'd sneak off and hide something, you know, and eat these things in their bedrooms and as kids. And certainly it was the same with me. And I think and then you kind of throw in the societal expectations of how you should look, and you got a sort of recipe for disaster, right? But and actually, I'm surprised that more of us don't have eating disorders, really. But so I think that it's so. I also think it's totally okay if you do want to comfort yourself with a tub of ice cream. Like I'm kind of on that that I just said journey again.
You did.
I'm on that journey.
You're going to say blue sky thinking in a minute, aren't you?
But of trying to kind of learn that foods aren't good or bad, and that actually. That I don't want to punish myself with food. I want to nourish myself with food, because that's the point of food, right?
Yeah.
But also, I think it's really important as women, especially, that we realise that like our worth is not reflected in what the bathroom scales say. You know, so like I think this really came up for me because my husband went on this like massive health drive in lockdown, and. Has lost a lot of weight, and people go, oh God, he's Harry just looks amazing, with this kind of reverence. And I'm like, yeah, he does, but I'm like, he's not a better person because he's lost 2 stone, do you know what I mean? Or, you know, and I think that I always think it's all of our souls are supposedly weigh 21 grams, yeah? That was some weird scientific experiment that went in the 1900s. Some doctor put dying people on the table and then weighed them before and after they died. And found that there was a difference of 21 grams. And he claimed that that was the soul. That was the soul leaving the body, right? So, you know, I suspect that might now not stand up to scientific rigor.
Possibly.
But what it does, I think it's a useful thing to remind ourselves that all souls are equal, right?
Yeah.
Okay? Regardless of what the rest of the body happens to weigh, you know? But we are so caught up in this kind of, and people feel so much shame about the food stuff, you know, not looking the way they should be, being too fat or too thin.
And it's also misleading. I remember many moons ago, I was going through a really traumatic time. And when I'm upset, I don't eat. Like, I just can't. Like, my body just won't let me. And so I'd lost loads of weight. And I remember at one point, 2 people in the office I was working in were like, oh my God, you're looking amazing. Well done. Like, da, da, da. And I remember thinking, I feel like I'm about to die. I'm having the most upsetting, traumatic time of my life. And yet you think I look amazing. This is insane. Yeah. But that's often what happens, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that I'm sort of, as I get older, my thing is that people can do what they want to do, do you know what I mean? I won't judge or anything like that. But I just want to live a life where I have enough positive coping mechanisms in my life that I don't feel the need to kind of regularly lose myself in something, be it food or drugs or alcohol or whatever, you know. And occasionally it's okay, like the world ain't gonna, but I get it, it's difficult because I'm still exploring it so much. In fact, as soon as I get off this podcast, I have a session with my CBT ED specialist.
Yeah.
And so, but I wanted to put it out there because I wanted to know that there were other people out there like me who did it, I guess. And lo and behold, there are a lot. And it makes me feel like, okay, I can do this. This is a normal brain human response to sort of is an ordinary human response to extraordinary human events, I think. Do you know what I mean? And so, and once I do that, I feel like it has a little less power over me. It's like, okay, we can get through this. We can do this. This is just like, this is the 2020, you know, chapter of the book.
Well, once you finish your CBT, you'll have to come back on and tell us all how to do it. That's the next thing.
Oh, no, I don't want to become like a... I don't think you'd want CBT from me. Be awful. But, you know, it's interesting, and I don't have any shame in talking about it. In fact, I have, the more I talk about these things, the less shame I feel about them, if that makes sense.
Absolutely.
Which is great, because shame is at the root of a lot of evil. Yeah.
Yeah. That's what they said to me when I went into rehab, into treatment, and you have to sort of sit around and talk about the worst things that happened to you when you were drinking and using. And I was like, I don't want to, you know, obviously.
I don't want to go there, thanks.
I remember a counsellor saying, Bryony, shame dies when you expose it to the light. And it's so true. I remember going, okay, I can do this. But it's sort of my mantra for life.
Now, I'm known for doing this, but I'm going to lower the tone ever so slightly.
Go on.
I want to talk about Prince Harry, Bryony.
Oh, yes, can we, Bryony?
We're ever so jealous.
What do you want to talk about him?
Well, the fact that you scored him for your pod, that's pretty huge.
Oh, right. Oh, yes, I did. I did.
Hey,
yes.
What? Hold on. Where were you going?
Yeah, where were you going with that?
No, I was kind of joking. I'm like, yes, what do you want to discuss? His move to America? Yes, I did. I did get him for my podcast, and I love him, you know.
I do. I have such a soft spot for him. To me, he'll always be that little boy. You know?
I just get on with him well. He's got that, I don't know, I remember when I first met him properly, because I was doing this work with Heads Together, and I ran the marathon for them the first time, and Heads Together was their mental health campaign.
Yes.
And there was just, you know, when you just meet that person and you're like, oh yeah, he gets it. And I don't know why he gets it, but... And every time I met him, we just had a laugh, and I was like, I was going to ask him if he'll do my podcast.
So did you just ask? And he said yes, and that was it?
Basically, yeah.
It's a very good lesson in if you don't ask, you don't get, right?
Well, that's what I told myself. I was like, well, what's the worst that's going to happen? He's going to say no. Of course he's going to say no. He's Prince Harry.
And were you surprised by how candid he was, or did you kind of have this inkling that he got it, so you knew he would be?
I suspected that I was, I don't know, I was surprised. I thought I was going to get a sort of generic chat about the importance of talking about mental health. And then when I got there, he was like, oh, can we just do it, the two of us, like not have any other people in, because I'm going to tell you, I just want to be comfortable. And then I was like, okay, he's going to say something. But I also wasn't surprised that he said what he said, given everything he's been through. You know?
Indeed.
But I love him and I love her. And, they're lovely, and I have, you know, I mean, I don't know them that well, but I know them.
I know, you're making it sound like you hang out all the time, jetting across to California.
Well, you know them more than us, Bryony.
No, I have hung out with them. Like, I have, you know, I've been to their house. I've not, you know.
Check it out, Bryony. But
seriously, because it makes me laugh when I see all the stuff in the newspaper about them, because I'm like, it doesn't translate for me, because I'm like, I've been there and they've like been like, oh, meet Archie, and I've like bounced him up and down on my bed, on my knee, and nearly dropped him. You know, they're just normal. They're like, you know, it's like this. Do you know what I mean?
They're just people. Yeah,
they are. And I think if you put the microscope, any family under a microscope, you'd come up with like similarly fantastic takes on what's going on. But
well, if the newspapers wanted to write about any of us all day, every day, imagine the stuff they'd dredge up or conclusions they'd come to. Do you know what I mean? Like, no one can withstand that amount of scrutiny. No one.
No, I don't. But I also think that, you know, that podcast really was a moment in...
It was a game changer. Like, someone that huge revealing something that significant is a big deal.
And I'm forever grateful that he chose to do that with me. And I think the fact that he chose to do it with, like, you know, someone who's not perfect and who's very flawed and very honest about those flaws was also a real kind of, like, that, I think.
Cool. Yeah.
Well, no, but I think it tells you what you need, you know, tells you
the measure of the man.
Yeah, like, it just, it was all very organic.
Oh, God, it's worse than Journey.
Riley, what are you turning into?
So tell us something about him that we would be surprised by, or that we don't know. It sounds, I think they've had it so tough. I find it, especially in light of the recent news that Meghan had a miscarriage, we all feel for her. and yet they're still just dragged through the press. And I get that some of it is part of the job, but it's not all part of the job. So what do we not know? You know, what should we all be thinking?
I genuinely don't know. I mean, I don't know them that well. So, I guess what you don't know, what I just said, is how normal they are. And I think there's a generosity in being in sharing those things like the miscarriage, because it really does help people.
Oh, a huge selfless act. Like, she got so much more scrutiny for having said it, but think of all the people she helped by saying, "You're not alone." Yeah. I get this. You're not alone.
So I have huge respect for that.
Me
and
too.
I just think they're great.
So we also think you're great, Bryony.
You're great.
Oh, this is so lovely. How do you want to be remembered?
Oh God, please, I'm only 40.
No, I know, we're just gonna, let's pretend you're dead.
Do you know something I don't?
No, but what I just think it's a good interesting question to ask someone kind of in their midlife, because it helps us understand why you're doing the things you're doing or where it is you think you're going.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I don't know.
So you're not a life plan kind of person?
Absolutely not. No. If I've learned anything, it's don't have a life plan. If you want to make a plan
and watch
as the universe howls with laughter at you.
A bit like birth plans, really, isn't it?
Yeah, goes. You think you're in control? Just go with the flow, trust, you know, enjoy. Like, you know, fucking hell, life's too short, isn't it? You know,
yeah,
and you never know. And so I just like, I try not to think actually beyond what I've got to do today, because otherwise I get very overwhelmed and start crying. There's the tears bit.
Well, and speaking of which, one of our last questions we always ask is, Bryony, what's for tea?
Oh, my God, that's a good question. I should know, because I'm doing this binge eating thing. I'll probably have some, like, chicken, rice and vegetables.
Gosh, you sound like a supermodel, Laura. Celebrities always say that, don't they? They're just a little piece of steamed fish.
No, it won't be little. It'll be like really big. And it'll be like chicken thighs. There'll be like 3 or 4 of them with the skin on and lots of rice. So it won't be little. No, but I like it. It's like a really nice, bulky, comforting, delicious and nutritious.
I think I want that for my tea now. Right, Wendy, I'm going to let you ask the last question because it's a bit embarrassing, but we ask it of everyone and we love it.
I'm just going to take a back seat now. Bye!
Buckle up, Bryony, buckle up.
Dear listener, I want you to know that she invented this question, not me, by the way. So, Bryony, you have to imagine, as weird as it sounds, that you are tucking Annie and I into bed. And you have to sing us your lullaby, please.
Oh, my God.
That's the usual reaction to this question.
What do you normally sing when your daughter needs a bit of comfort?
I sing Cuddles with Edie, Cuddles with Edie. There's no better way to spend a day.
I love that. Did you make that up yourself?
Yeah, and she goes, Cuddles with Mommy, Cuddles with Mommy. There's no better way to start the day.
Oh, that's so nice.
That's what I do. I mean, as you can tell, I'm not a natural singer.
You're better than me.
I think you did a marvellous job. So we ask this of every podcast. We've had some very well-known singers refuse. We've had hymns. We've had sort of tucking in rituals instead of lullabies. We've had everything, haven't we, Wend?
We have. CBeebies features heavily.
But you're one of the only self-penned songs that we... So we could well see a future career in music, I feel, with Bryony
Cuddles,
Gordon.
Cuddles with Annie, Cuddles with Wendy. There's no better way to spend the day.
I am going to put that as my ringtone on my phone.
I have to go to therapy now, guys.
Yeah, go. Go and be therapized. And I feel therapized by you, so thank you.
I feel therapized as well. Thank you for chatting to me. Thanks for letting me whitter away.
Well, no, just keep being brilliant, please, because the world needs you. I need you.
I need you too. Thank you. I really enjoyed this. It's been lovely. And
thank you,
Bryony. I wish that we could have done it you know, with a cup of...
Should we do a day-long podcast next time?
let's do it. Let's just... 24 hours.
Let's I suspect already nobody would listen to us three for a day.
But would we care? No, we wouldn't. We would just enjoy ourselves. All right, bye. Have a great day. Bye, Bryony. Thank you.